From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made roughly 13.7 or 8 billion years ago, and it only lasted for a fraction of a second, a very small fraction, 10 to the negative 35th of a second. It has a decimal point, then 34 zeros before a 1. What happened in that 100 million billion billion billionth of a second? You know, not much, other than maybe the birth of the universe that we live in. Scientists believe the Big Bang was an instant and then a rapid expansion began. The question is, how could we possibly know that? For many years, we suspected something like that probably happened. We've been lacking some of the evidence that science wants and demands. Well, yesterday might have changed everything. The scientific world was rocked off its foundation with an announcement of new evidence, evidence that helps explain how the Big Bang happened and what followed. Imagine you're standing on the shore of a lake with your back to the water. Someone drops a rock in the lake hundreds of yards from shore. You didn't see the rock enter at that moment. You weren't there. But eventually you will notice the faint ripples arriving at your feet, and you know that something happened, even if you weren't there to see it. In the most basic terms, that is how I am trying to wrap my head around the science we heard about yesterday, but do not take my word for it. We've got two guests who can answer your questions and explain how scientists are reacting to this news. Adam Frank of the University of Rochester is a theoretical and computational astrophysicist. He writes NPR's popular science blog called 13.7 Cosmos and Culture. Adam, welcome to Connections.
Great to be here.
And Dr. Brian Koberline is an astrophysicist at RIT and writes a science blog of his own. I've linked to it on Twitter. Outstanding work there. And Dr. Koberline, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's glad to be here.
Adam, I'm going to start with you and ask you to explain what we think we heard yesterday and why the science world is so fired up about what was announced yesterday.
So, people understand like the basic idea of the Big Bang, that, 13.7 billion years ago, the universe began in a, explosion of all space-time, matter, energy, and dimension. That theory has been, that basic idea of the expansion of the universe from a, very compressed state has been in, fairly well understood, and there's a lot of good data for it. It's been around for at least 50, 60 years, and we have really good evidence to believe that's true. But around 30 years or so, people began to find some problems with the Big Bang theory, so they had to add something new to it that they call inflation. And in inflation, at a very, very early moment after the Big Bang, you get a small sliver of the universe rapidly expanding to become everything that we can see today. And that idea of inflation is absolutely necessary for the Big Bang to work, but it's been contentious. And there's been some data for it, but not much. Yesterday, we think we saw the first data that really tells us that inflation happened.
And Dr. Koberline, let's talk about the actual physical way this analysis has been carried out. This research was done. It is so fascinating to me to try to get a look at our universe. And what were the researchers doing? What did they explain and how did they do it?
Basically, they were looking at light coming from what we call the cosmic microwave background, which is kind of the first clear light of the universe. That was when the universe was about 380,000 years old. And they were looking at something called polarization, and the way the light is twisted or affected by gravitational waves from this inflationary period.
Okay, and their actual equipment to measure this is what? How did they do that?
They have detectors on a chip that detect the polarization of light in microwaves.
And to me, it's really remarkable stuff. We're going to get into the application and the implications of this in a moment, but we do want to understand exactly what this means here. And again, I've linked to Adam and Brian have both written about this today, and we've linked to that on our Twitter pages. I really recommend it because they explain it very well, but they don't dumb it down to the point where you miss the science. So I want to get into the science of it. Adam, when you heard what you heard, and you sort of gave us a sense on Friday that this was coming, when you heard it yesterday, what stood out to you as being, did anything stand out as boy, this is interesting, but I'm not sure I'm buying this, or were there any flags that you want to see followed up on? Give me a sense for what you saw yesterday.
Well, I think, I was amazed at how strong the signal that they found was. Now, of course, okay, so we first start off with, this is the first announcement of their result. The paper is going to have to go through, an amazing amount, and will go through an amazing amount of scrutiny. People are going to beat this result to death to find anything that could be possibly wrong with it. So, 6 months from now, who knows? Perhaps we will have found things that are systematically wrong with it that we're going to not believe it. But at least at a first sense. You know, this is a team that's been working on this for a long time. They have to do this down in the South Pole. These guys have been working very hard under very hard conditions to get this data. They're very careful. So at first glance, it really looks pretty. It looks like a pretty good shot at something that people have been hoping for to be able to measure for 30 years.
And Brian is nodding along with you, Adam. And Brian and I were talking before we started here. I'm always amazed at how the news media wants to grab an easy headline, whether it's research about Alzheimer's disease or the Big Bang or whatever it is. We love an easy big headline. Sometimes we overplay results of study that needs more review. And researchers are often the one who tell us, hey, calm down, guys. This is, we got some time with this. But Brian, you walked in here today and said it's sort of hard to contain the excitement over this one.
It is. I mean, on the outside, you take this kind of professional veneer where you're very calm and collected and say, we have to analyze this data. On the inside, it's like kindergarten all over again, and we get cookies and milk. I mean, it's this huge thing. We jump up and down on the inside.
But as Adam said here, we're going to need to see more and more study, and we will. And one of the big issues that Brian wrote about is some of the numbers, and I want to get into what the numbers mean. So, Brian, when you wrote about, they were looking, and I'm going to screw up the numbers here because, again, my job is to be the ignorant host, and you're, Adam and Brian are helping us explain. Is there another satellite, the Planck, that it can also measure the same kind of thing?
Yes, there's a Planck satellite that's also looking at the cosmic microwave background and can also look at the polarization, which is how they're measuring these gravity waves.
And so what we thought this team might find, the numbers they had, the information they presented, was even more dramatic, is that a fair way to say it, than what you'd expected?
Right.
Explain.
You can measure the strength of the gravitational waves, and we typically do this in what's known as R, which is kind of the ratio of the gravitational waves to the density fluctuations within the early period. The Planck satellite had some initial upper limits on what R would be, and that was that it probably is going to be less than 0.11. And this new study has found that it's 0.2, which is larger than we would expect. That's surprising. That's saying that these gravitational waves are actually stronger than we initially anticipated.
What next with that, though? I mean, is there a chance that if these waves they discovered are so strong, could there have been either an error in the data, an error in the way they collected?
That's one of the things we're going to look at really closely. I mean, everybody's going to pick at that. Anytime you have an unexpected result, particularly when it seems to be in conflict with earlier data, you're going to really scrutinize that. Now, they're done in different ways, so there may not be a conflict depending on how inflation occurred. But that's one of the areas that we want to worry about. The other thing is we want to see where the Planck data comes in. They're still analyzing their polarization data. I believe in 2015 they'll have their results. The questions will be how that matches up.
And when do we? So sometime maybe next year we get.
I believe in 2015. The last I checked, they could be having earlier. I don't know. But
Adam Frank, your thoughts on those same numbers when you saw the data that was released yesterday?
Well, again, I think one thing important to understand is that when inflation was first proposed, so, inflation is this theory of the early, early, early universe. I mean, there's not enough earlies to put, in front of that. That it was pretty quickly in the 1980s that people recognized, like, whoa, these things, it's so violent at this early stage of the universe that there should be these gravitational waves that Einstein predicted, that, there are these ripples in space-time, that these should also be should be produced. So it's been 30 years that people have been saying, like, look, there should be gravity waves generated at this time. And the BICEP data is like really the first time, so people have been going after, been looking, been planning to look for this for a while. And this is really the first, good look at this kind of data, or first time we've gotten this kind of data. The Planck was the beginning, and the full range of Planck data, as we talked about before, is going to be coming out. But so this is still really, this is like a first shot at this. So we should expect more to happen and more interesting things to happen. But one of the exciting things is this is the first time we've even got a way of getting these numbers.
We're talking to a couple of the sharpest science minds anywhere, and they happen to have an astrophysics background, so they're helping us understand the big news. Dr. Brian Koeberlein from RIT, and you might know Adam Frank from the University of Rochester, and also one of the co-authors of NPR's popular science blog called 13.7 Cosmos and Culture. Good chance for you to jump in with a question or a comment, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And for our listeners, here's how we're structuring this hour. We're going to try to wrap a lot of science in till about 1240, 1245, and then we're going to shift our attention to what's going on in Ukraine and talk to some other guests as well. So we're jamming some science in here. I want to start with Brian on the question I'm hearing most often from people today is, even if I understand it, what's the application, Brian?
Well, the thing about applications is that whenever you're doing cutting-edge research, you don't know yet what the applications are going to be. I mean, when there was early research on lasers, we had no idea that they were going to become laser pointers and CD players. This is cutting-edge research. This is an amazing amount of effort in which we are able to detect light coming from the earliest moments of the universe. And that's astounding. The type of technology that it takes to do this has implications that we don't even realize yet.
Adam, how would you answer the question when people say, what can you envision for application of this kind of information, if we can get good confirmation of what we heard yesterday?
Well, I think it's always, again, a similar point. Let me tell you a story about something that was totally blue sky research. Back in the late 80s, there was a guy at the computational science laboratory who was trying to figure out a way of getting scientists to share information. And, he was actually a graduate student. And, he was just sort of putting things together. How can I get people to share things? And he invented this thing called a web browser. And the point of the web browser was just to allow astronomers to share pictures, right? And so tell me how much money was generated out of this guy doing this thing that was really not related at all to anything. There was no application that he could see at the time, right? So you just with this is why we publicly fund science, is because what looks like blue sky today, which it's so easy for the enemies of science to say, well, why are we wasting money on this? But, the laser is a great example. The web is another example. These were all blue sky at the time, and you could point to them and say this is purposeless. And maybe somebody wants to say that. Even on the comments on my blog, I could see people saying, why are we funding this kind of crazy research about 10 to the minus 30? And there's the answer. There's two perfect answers about why we do it.
We're talking to Adam Frank and Brian Koberlein, talking about the big science news of the week. This is so big that we couldn't even wait until our science roundtable, our monthly science roundtable. It's nice to have big breaking science news. Adam, to your point, are you concerned that we're not prioritizing funding for these kind of projects? And is this a shot to those who would say cut funding?
Oh, God. I mean, the science in the United States is really in trouble right now. We're seeing an enormous hit to science all across the board, not just astronomy, but, biosciences, everything. There was an interesting article in the New York Times this Sunday about how, billionaires are sort of stepping up to the plate to fund science, which the government used to fund, which is great that they're doing it, but it also poses enormous, enormous problems. The United States is really in danger of losing its preeminence. Let me remind people that we have no way with what's going on. You're going to be talking about the Ukraine. We have no way of getting into space anymore. Like, basically, if Russia pulls the plug on their Soyuz capsules, we cannot get Americans back down from the space station or get them up to the space station. So, our funding for science has really taken a hit over the last few years, our last decades or so. So, yeah, we're really in danger of losing our preeminence.
A couple of comments, and you can follow me at Evan Dawson on Twitter. Adam Frank and Brian Koberlein are both on Twitter as well. Ryan says, cool stuff, but I still don't understand how we can know what this team was looking at. I think what he's saying is, how do you know it's from the Big Bang? So if you missed the early part of our discussion, we're talking about the big news that there is some scientific data now that we are confirming at least some things about the birth of our universe. Brian, when Ryan asked on Twitter, cool stuff, but how do you know that's from the Big Bang? How would you answer that?
Well, we know it's from the Big Bang because the light that we're looking at has a very distinctive signature. The early thing, what we call the cosmic microwave background, occurred when the universe was finally transparent. It occurred at a very specific time. And over time, that light is cooled, and it is now within a wavelength of microwaves. And we can see that very clearly. We can distinguish it from other things. So we know that is coming from that period. And what the team was doing here is they were looking at patterns within that light. So they know it's from that part of the Big Bang. They look at patterns within that light, and they see how those patterns match inflation, and it seems to match it very well.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. Adam, when we think about the Big Bang, the human mind tends to think of things in very finite, easily understood terms, and so it's hard to think about 10 to the negative 35th, I think, in terms of a second. And it's also hard to think about as a tiny universe and then rapid expansion. But give me the best sense that you can explain for what we now know about the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, it occurs, and then an expansion that has since slowed, or give me a sense for how we understand it.
Well, the first thing to understand is that the Big Bang is not a theory of the beginning of the universe. It's a theory of what happened after the beginning. We don't really know how the universe began, right? We don't have the equations yet to really understand how you can go from nothing to something. And, you know, that's such a deep philosophical issue. It's not even sure that you know, how science would address that specific kind of issue. So, you know, if we have an infinite universe before that, if there wasn't a Big Bang and the universe went on infinitely, we could deal with that. But so I just want to, you know, emphasize that really what the Big Bang gives us is a theory of exactly right after the expansion starts. And so we now believe, this is weird, that space is infinite. There's an infinite amount of space. And that means also that space began infinite. So when we talk about expansion, what we're talking about is that any two points that you could choose, you know, in space are moving, you know, at the beginning of the Big Bang, everything began moving away from each other. So it's not like the Big Bang happened. It wasn't in space. It was space. And it was an expansion of all space. Everything's getting carried away from everything else. What inflation does is it takes a tiny sliver of that post-Big Bang space, and this amazing quantum mechanical transition happens where that tiny bit of space inflates wildly, very quickly, for a very short amount of time, and that part of space-time is what becomes the observable universe. And after inflation ends, that part of space-time relaxes back and begins expanding at the rather leisurely rate that we see today. So there's the Big Bang, then there's this rapid inflation, then things sort of slow down and go back to their normal rate of expansion. And now what we're seeing, though, there's actually at this point in cosmic time, space is beginning to accelerate. The expansion of space-time is actually beginning to speed up. And some people think the acceleration of the universe now may have something to do with inflation back then, but we don't really know how.
Brian, what do you need to see next to confirms maybe the wrong word, to strengthen our confidence from what we saw yesterday?
Well, the easy answer is we need more data. I mean, what
is Planck enough? If we get data next year from Planck, are we going to see separate? And are scientists and researchers competitive enough to say, hey, if these guys got anything wrong, I want to jump in there and get my slice of this?
We love beating each other in terms of analyzing data. You know, we like to push against each other in terms of ideas. Planck is going to be a interesting one, because if Planck comes in the same level, if we find that this research and the Planck data agree, then I think we have a much more confident view of what that early universe period was. If they don't agree, then we're not sure. We've got contradictory evidence, and that's where we are going to need more. We're going to have to figure out what's going on.
Talking to Adam Frank and Brian Koberline about big science news yesterday related to, I keep saying the birth of our universe, but Adam is correctly pointing out that it's sometime right after maybe the birth, and I'm not even sure. This is going to be a very strange thing to say. I'm not even sure how we characterize it, because I don't have a fear of not knowing, and I don't need to fill the void with something. I think there is a human tendency to want to put sort of our finite brains around either the birth of a universe or whatever. What's amazing to me, Adam, is that that if we don't know, we may not get the answers in your and my lifetime and Brian's lifetime. Einstein was smart enough to know 98 years ago that this is something we may eventually get to understanding, which is a pretty remarkable thing. Does it trouble you that there are certain things that we may not know for a long time or ever?
No, not at all, because, you know, the whole process, science doesn't guarantee absolute answers about everything. Science is a way of behaving in the world. You know, science is a way of interrogating or having a conversation with the world. And, you know, like any conversation, it's always ongoing. And there may be some things that, you know, it depends on the technology you have, you know, whether you can ask those kinds of questions. And, you know, I don't think we have to think that science is always going to produce all the answers. What is remarkable about it is how many answers, you know, things that previously were thought to be completely outside the domain of human understanding, that science has actually embraced.
What do you think? Same question, Brian. I love talking to scientists about this notion, because, you know, when we talk about the beginning of time, it's sort of a silly thing, but what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that we often talk about in the popular press about the Big Bang being the beginning, but in the actual science, we're standing in the present and looking backwards into the past. So this is just looking further back and further back as we keep studying this. We can't, you know, there's a limit to how far back we can go, and there may always be that limit, and that's fine. We'll keep pushing as far back as we can.
So I'm reading Brian's blog post now, and he writes about, the universe in its earliest moments, and again, as we understand it, and this inflationary period. Brian, is there anything that we've gotten wrong or that we've had to correct, and is there any concern that as we try to understand, because Adam has said in the last 30 years, we started to say, okay, maybe we need to understand inflation, and we're going to have to try to confirm some of this. But some of us, you know, who aren't in the science world say, okay, so in the last 30 years, you're looking for more to help explain the Big Bang, and now you're saying you found it. But how do you know that's not confirmation bias? How are we certain about this, and were we wrong about anything?
Well, we always try to keep in the back of our mind the possibility of confirmation bias. That's constant. And if you look at the history of astronomy, you'll find lots of areas where we got it wrong, kind of. One of the things to keep in mind is that the models that we reject not because they've stopped working, but because we've found some model that works better. So if you go back to Copernicus and the sun-centered circular orbits, we replaced that with Kepler, and then we replaced that with Newton, and we replaced that with Einstein. But Newton works just as well as it did in the 1600s when Newton came up with it. There's nothing that has failed in Newton's model. What we found is more evidence, and we've changed the way we view the world.
We're going to get to the phones in just a second, but Brian's comment there reminds me of what I heard recently about philosophy being the only field in which you know eventually your work will be proven wrong. And I think science is sort of in, it's not that it's wrong, it's that it's improved upon, right? I guess that's the point.
Right. I mean, you could say that it's wrong because it's not exactly the truth or something, but I think keeping in mind that science is about modeling, science is about developing the best understanding you have, and that's also being cautious that you could be wrong. The exciting part about science is that you come up with an understanding, but you also recognize that you can move beyond that understanding for a new model.
New evidence can move us. That's always, always important. Mindy in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Ooh, Mindy, can you hear me, Mindy? Go ahead.
Yes. My question, I realize, has no answer. I'm just asking, actually, to pick the brains what these astrophysicists think without proof. This is my question. Do they think the term universe is really an oxymoron because there are multiple universes and that the inflation that occurred instantaneously right after the Big Bang, was that due to the force of a cataclysmic collision between one of the other universes and what we have now?
Mindy, thanks for the call. And I wonder, Adam, if she was reading your blog today about the multiverse universe thing, how do you want to address that?
Yeah, that's a very, very scientifically astute question. So the interesting thing about inflation, as I've said, you know, inflation takes a little tiny shred of the post-Big Bang universe and expands it. But as soon as inflation came out, it didn't take long for people to say, well, what about the rest of the universe? And now almost, you know, most people would agree that if you have inflation, then you probably have internal inflation, which means that you are constantly getting other pieces of the universe inflating to create their own what we call pocket universes. So many people would argue that inflation naturally leads to a multiverse, a universe of universes. And so, you know, now I've never been really happy with that idea, but I have to admit today that inflation, you know, this is really good. This seems to be, you know, we'll see what, if it lasts, but this points us in the direction that inflation is true. So that does perhaps point to the existence of a multiverse. She's also referring to the idea called the cyclic model, which is different from inflation, which is very different from inflation. Actually, is a competing model from inflation, which is where you still have different universes, but there's actually the collision between two of the universes, which actually generates this rapid period of expansion. And that actually stands in, that's Steinhardt and Turek, two scientists, developed that idea, and it stands in contradiction to the standard models of inflation. And actually, the great thing is they predict a different spectrum of gravitational waves than inflation does. So we're actually going to have the ability now, hopefully, to distinguish between standard inflation and this what's called the cyclic model. And, you know, we'll actually be able to test these against each other.
Very good questions from Mindy. And I've got to let Adam go. So, Adam, as I let you go, let me give you the job that you don't have and probably don't want. But if you are the headline writer of the Washington Post on a morning like this after yesterday, and unfortunately you have to try to get a headline out of this, what's the headline?
I'm going to probably choose the one I put on my blog. New window on birth of universe opened.
Awesome stuff. It's always great to hear from you, and hopefully we'll talk to you again very soon. Thanks for joining us today, Adam.
It was a pleasure. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Frank joining us. And Brian, what's your headline?
You don't get a catchy headline. You should read this. It's that important.
I love it. See? And sometimes we have to take our medicine, though, and accept that. And that's part of why I have so much enjoyed coming over and spending the first few months on this talk show, and that I worked in traditional media for a long time. And again, not to malign the work they do, but, you know, to reduce something to 90 seconds, you can't really do this on the nightly news in 90 seconds, can you?
No, well, I don't think you can do it in a real justice. I mean, I think one of the important things to recognize here is that we are able to probe the earliest moments of the universe. And that, for where we are in the universe, is astounding. The fact that we can actually look from billions of years into the past and know something about what happened then is an astounding amount of work. And this new research is one more step further in that.
I want to make sure we also understand it, because Adam explained it in a sense. I'd love to hear your take on, if we get a question on, what is the difference between a universe and a multiverse? We hear multiverse, and a lot of us think, oh, it's a bunch of parallel universes that sort of exist simultaneously, and, these sci-fi versions. What does science say about a multiverse?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I think what this research actually shows is it's forcing us to kind of rethink what we mean by universe and in terms of what we can observe. Universe has been used in the past in different ways. We used to refer to our galaxy as the universe because it was thought that our galaxy of stars was all there was. And then we found out that, in fact, there were other island universes, other galaxies. And so we changed universe to mean all of the galaxies. And we've kind of referred to universe as everything there is, because we figured that everything there is was something that we could see. But we now know that because of the finite speed of light, because the universe is expanding, there's a limit to how far we can go. And what we would consider the universe expands beyond that. So do we call that a separate universe? Do we call it a multiverse? Do we call all of the universes the whole universe? Do we refer to it as the cosmos? It's a terminology that's going to settle at some point, but right now, we aren't sure.
A couple more quick questions with Dr. Brian Koberlein. Michelle on Twitter, you mentioned the word cosmos, says, great show today. Pairs well with Cosmos, the resurgence of the show, Neil deGrasse Tyson hosting now. And Michelle says, is this part of a resurgence of science in the mainstream?
I would hope so. I mean, a lot of times you get asked about what do you think of Cosmos and the new Cosmos, and I think it's great. We could use 20 more of them, to be absolutely honest. I mean, the more we can communicate science, the more clearly we can communicate science, I think the more robust our society will be.
And John on Twitter wants to know, why do we keep saying 13.7 or 13.8 billion years? How do we know, and how did we get that number? You've got 30 seconds, Brian.
Because we're really smart.
Yeah.
No. There are things like the cosmic microwave background, and if we look at the variations in that, that gives us a certain age. If we look at the distribution of galaxies, what's called the baryon acoustic oscillation, it's the distribution or clustering of galaxies, that tells us an age. We can combine these different types of data, and we get something on the order of 13.77 billion years ago was the origin of our universe.
Has that number been pretty steady for a while?
It has been relatively steady. I mean, we have gone from somewhere 10, 20 billion years down to 13.7, 13.8.
So you're sort of narrowing?
Yes. There is some tension between different observations. And so that's why we kind of back off and say, well, 13.7, 13.8.
But that's a pretty solid range. Would you be surprised if 25 years from now it's a 25 billion number there? I mean, there's nothing that suggests we're that far off.
There's nothing that suggests we're that far off, but yeah, I would be surprised. I think 13.8 is a good range, and it seems to be pretty robust in terms of the information that we have.
And I'd like you to finish off our discussion by giving a grade to your mainstream media, because it is important that the media, we joke about writing headlines and whatnot, but it is important that the media, I think, do their best to understand. And, you know, maybe part of the reason that science has needed this resurgence, you know, Michelle's question is this part of a resurgence of science, is because the media treats science like the broccoli of the world, and we treat, you know, the Kardashians as the dessert, and we serve dessert first, and then no one wants broccoli.
Right.
Is the media doing a better job? How would you grade the media at large with science?
I think it depends on what you're referring to as the media. There are so many different avenues, and there are some very, very good science reporting done online and sometimes in the mainstream media and sometimes not. I think when you come down to it, it really rests on the duty of the scientists to work better at communicating this stuff. I mean, we're the ones that are supposed to know what's going on. We're the ones that should be explaining it and helping the journalists communicate it better.
Pretty amazing stuff today, and pretty remarkable news from the science world. It's not just the science world. How about this? It's just news. It's not necessarily science news.
It's just news. It's big news.
It's just news about the early stages of our universe. And for more information, again, if you jump in my Twitter feed, I've been trying to throw up some links that two of the very best at helping explain this in a way that you can see it. Sometimes you need a chart or a graph or an illustration. And Adam Frank and Brian Koberline do that just absolutely beautifully. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sure we'll talk to you again very, very soon on one of our science roundtables or elsewhere. But nice to have breaking science news. We're going to take a short break here on Connections, and we're going to come back and talk about a subject that has unfortunately elbowed its way back into the news this week. That's Crimea, Ukraine, and more. A few weeks ago on this program, we heard from some members of the local Ukrainian community, and they warned us about exactly what was going to happen in Crimea. We saw it come to pass, and so now the question is, what's next? We're going to try to get an answer for you. You're listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.
Documentary lovers take note. The critically acclaimed documentary Tim's Vermeer opens this week at the Little. The film follows Tim Jennison, a Texas-based inventor who attempts to solve one of the greatest mysteries in all of art. How did 17th century Dutch master Johannes Vermeer manage to create a painting strikingly similar to photographs 150 years before the invention of photography? The epic research project Jennison embarks on to test his theory is as extraordinary as what he discovers. Learn more at thelittle.org.
Welcome back to Connections on this Tuesday afternoon, and we're revisiting a subject that a lot of us wish we didn't have to talk about, but unfortunately there's so much more dissension and strife in Crimea, Ukraine, and the question is, what's going to happen next? A few weeks ago we heard from a diverse panel of native Ukrainians, Russians, and Ukrainian Americans as well, and they gave us a sense of what might happen in Crimea. And Elena Delai is a mathematics professor at MCC. She warned us that in Crimea, the pro-Ukrainian faction, which is much larger than is being represented, was being suppressed. And Elena, I hate to say it, but it's nice to have you back, and I hate to say it, but everything that you warned us about came to pass, didn't it?
Well, it did, and as it has to, unfortunately, very so much. What happened in Crimea on Sunday, the falsification was very open. Nobody even tried to show that it was a fair election, but yet it is presented to the world as if it was. Nobody accepts it, but Russia doesn't care.
You told us a few weeks ago that Crimea wasn't so simple as breaking it down saying, oh, it's pro-Russian, you know, that it was much more diverse from the Tatar population to the pro-Ukrainian population. What do you suspect an actual accurate breakdown would be if they truly had a referendum and a fair vote? What do you suspect a breakdown would be, Elena?
Well, you see, I'm not sure if it is my place to speculate, but I'll tell you this. I don't think that it is just about being Russian-speaking, as Putin tries to put it. It is more than that. Many Russian-speaking citizens would like to live in Ukraine, would like to be a part of Ukraine. If you think about Tatars, they didn't vote. About 0.5% of them went to vote. If you think about Ukrainians who live in Crimea, some of them went to vote. I'll tell you, I don't want to say it as a fact, but I've seen some pictures online here and there, and I don't know, you know, whether they can be used as a true representation, but there were pictures of Ukrainian favoring vote overwhelmingly overcoming Russian favoring vote in some of the voting stations. However, that most likely was falsified. So we really don't know what the outcome would have been. But what I know is that masses of Crimean people are trying to run away now. Western Ukraine is accepting those who would like to get away from Crimea at this point, and there are thousands of people who are begging for Lviv Oblast, Lviv region in the Western Ukraine, and others to take them for the time being, and then so they can figure out what to do with their lives. But they obviously don't want to live with Russia.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're on for about the next 15 minutes with Elena Delai. Elena, tell us about your background, where you are from originally.
I am from Lviv, which is a Ukrainian city in western Ukraine. It's closer to Polish border. It is a very pro-Ukrainian part of the country. Eastern parts are more so pro-Russian because it was historically developed in connection to Holodomor, which was a tragedy of 1932-1933, and then also their historical positioning and geographical positioning in the country. But I've lived here in Rochester for the past 20 years. In my heart, I'm still Ukrainian.
And it was a few weeks ago that Elena spoke with such clarity over what's happening in Crimea, and that's why we wanted to find out more about what might happen next. One of the things that we are hearing, Elena, is that there is concern in the international community that if there is any kind of nominal acceptance that Crimea is going to be part of Russia, that Russia will then look to eastern Ukraine. Because they're, you know, my basic understanding is that it's sort of a sliding scale. You go east to west, and farther east in Ukraine, there's more Russian-speaking, a little bit more of a Russian background, and maybe perhaps more pro-Russian citizens. And the concern is that Crimea is not the last domino, that there are other cities that might also talk about annexation, might hold their own referendums. What do you hear about that?
Well, it is a very valid concern at this point. I don't think that what happened in Crimea was spontaneous. After Olympics, Putin all of a sudden decided to do the spontaneous overtaking of Crimea. I don't believe that was something he came up with on a spot. It seems to me like it was a well-developed plan that probably has been sitting in Moscow for quite some time, and the time that evolved in Ukraine with a rising of Maidan and people and what happened to Yanukovych, that was just an opportune time. So it seems to me like he has this well-developed plan. It seems to me that once the Crimea now, he is considering Crimea his, he will try to step his foot further down. If you think about his offer to Ukraine at this point, so he wants to federalize Ukraine. He wants each region to have more independent power. And should that ever happen, and we all pray that it will never happen, what would happen to different regions of Ukraine would be the same thing that we've seen in Crimea just now, right? So he could then piece by piece take Ukraine and make it part of Russia. So his goal, I believe, is much bigger than the goal of just taking the Crimea from Ukraine. I would not be surprised if the next thing we saw was Putin stepping his foot with military on eastern parts of Ukraine.
John in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hi, Elena.
Hi.
You know, did I hear or read right that it was a 97% victory margin?
I think in the 96 point something was the final total. And frankly, John, when we see elections around the world in which, you know, for example, Saddam Hussein's last election, he got more than 99%. If anybody thinks that Iraqis would have voted freely at 99%, it just seems so silly and so difficult to believe that I don't know why you have leaders of regimes who think that the world will buy into that. But yes, in fact, the numbers were in the 96 point something. That was the last number I saw. And Putin's response is not to say, well, that's obviously inaccurate. His response is to say, that is free and just.
Well, you know, it just sounds overwhelming to me. And even Ahmadinejad in Iran, when he won his last presidential race,
right,
he got only, I think, 68% of the vote. So I'm thinking 97% doesn't sound too bad. Believe me, I am not a Russian backer, far from it. But I don't know. I think it's possible that the Crimeans wanted independence in a vast majority.
Well, hold on one second, John. Stay there, because here's another important point that we haven't gotten to yet. They had two options on their ballot. And you say they wanted independence. They didn't vote for independence. They vote for essential annexation to Russia. The other option was more autonomy from Ukraine. There was not a third option that said status quo. They weren't even allowed to vote for anything that was pro-Ukrainian. So, you know, it's a pretty remarkable ballot in that it didn't even represent an option that would have said, hey, we don't want any change. Elena, am I correct about that?
You're absolutely correct. And also, when people started looking closer at numbers, turned out that in one of the cities, Sevastopol, 123% of people who actually physically live there, that includes babies and children, and apparently those who died, voted, according to the numbers provided by the government. Tatars didn't go to vote at all. Very, very like meager, 0.5% of them went. And they were really active in previous voting. So if you think that they withheld their voices, where did all this come from? It was so falsified. And to me, the sad part is, if you think about the reaction Russia had today to sanctions which U.S. imposed on them, they ridiculed them. So to me, the combination of all these things just tells you they don't care. They know that everyone sees black from white. They keep telling you the other way, and they simply don't care what the world thinks.
And John, let me just follow up by saying it's roughly equivalent to saying, you know, you live in Rochester, and you've got a vote coming up on Sunday, and hey, you know, you can vote however you want. Here are your two options. Rochester becomes its own nation separate of New York, or Rochester becomes part of Canada. What would you like? And if you're sitting there going saying, hey, I don't want any change at all, I'm happy with Rochester being part of New York, well, you know, it's not an option. And then, so that's sort of what happened for the pro-Ukrainian folks in Crimea.
Okay, Evan. I didn't realize that, but it sounds pretty strong. It sounds like it's just a region that goes with Russia.
Okay, and John,
or
thanks.
Sympathizes with Russia.
Sure.
Which I don't, by the way.
Well, I appreciate the call, and thank you very much, John. And Elena, to John's point, he sees that 97% number, and he thinks, okay, it might be fishy, but even if it was a fully represented number, that's probably a region that wants to be annexed to Russia. Why not?
Well, I'm going to come back to what you said. What we've seen on the ballot, what options were for people. So that right there doesn't give you any option to see whether anyone wants to be part of Ukraine as they are now. So that has to be noted. And other than that, if you vote under the gun points, I don't know. Do you have a choice?
Yeah, there's a larger, broader question about the potential moral hazards of allowing secession, not just in Crimea, but around the world. It's one reason that, you know, this may seem like a strange parallel to folks, but, you know, if you read what Abraham Lincoln and William Seward wrote about the South's attempt to secede during the Civil War, you know, Lincoln's concern was you have to keep the Union together. His first goal was to save the Union. His first goal was not to eliminate slavery, though he wanted to eliminate slavery. His first goal was to save the Union because he worried that you allow secession and you have no stable country going forward. And that doesn't mean you never allow any changing of borders. But, you know, I suspect, Elena, that if there were a vote in Crimea, maybe Crimeans would want to join Russia. But it doesn't appear that that's all that this is about. It appears that there might be a wider, broader goal for Mr. Putin and others. And that's what a lot of folks are worried about. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, absolutely fair. And back in 2008, Putin made a remark at one of the NATO summits that Ukraine is not happening as an independent country, that they occupy some of the former Russian territories. So it might be believed that even then, that plan of overtaking some of the Ukrainian territories, which he believes should belong to Russia, might have been conceived, and all these years he might have been developing it. But at this point, it is a very scary moment because even though I have been trying to be optimistic and have been trying to think that maybe we can peacefully resolve the issue at this point, it doesn't look very good. It looks grim.
We're talking to Elena Delai, who was born in Western Ukraine and now teaches at MCC and has been offering her take and just, you know, just sort of the general observations of someone from that region. And so, Elena, we heard Senator John McCain and Senator Dick Durbin speaking, and not necessarily in lockstep, but speaking about the fact that if the Ukrainians have an army, it is much smaller than Russia's army, and very, very small part of the Ukrainian army is actually combat ready. No one wants to think about a combat situation. But is there wisdom in the American side at least getting involved to say we're going to help with arming or training just in case of that eventuality? What do you think, and what do your friends and family say about that?
You know, nobody wants war. I can totally see that anyone who lives in this country, after having Afghanistan and Iraq, doesn't want another war. Nor do we, the Ukrainians. That would be the last thing that we would want. And to say that, oh, we think that, you know, we all should go and fight for our freedom, yeah, we should, but we are trying to do it diplomatically, which is not working very well. As far as U.S. support, they have an obligation, want it or not. That memorandum of 1994, when Ukraine gave up the nuclear weapons, them and Britain, they have an obligation. Russia now is invading Ukraine's territory, and I do believe that U.S. should do everything in their power to help Ukraine out. It is a very hard question to answer, but this is probably all I'm going to say. I just hope that they will help Ukraine as much as they possibly can.
Elena, we're certainly hoping, no matter what our personal views are about Russia or Ukraine or Mr. Putin or others, I think it's fair to say that we're all rooting for peace, and so I hope the next time we speak it's in slightly calmer circumstances. But thank you for sharing your views and your time with us this afternoon.
Absolutely.
It's Elena Delai, teaches at MCC and from the western part of Ukraine. Very difficult situation there, but we will continue to follow it for you here. Short break, and in 90 seconds, we come back and we talk about a rather big bit of news from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They're talking about births in this country, and they want to see fewer C-sections. They have some ideas about how to do that, and there could be some pretty serious impacts. We're going to talk about all of that with a diverse panel next.